Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's the Senate's turn now. The leadership in the Senate is working to create their own version of a bill to replace Obamacare. A team of 13 Republican senators working through the Memorial Day recess are attempting to rewrite a bill that dovetails off of the American Health Care Act, which passed in the House by a very slim margin before the Congressional Budget Office had a chance to rate the bill. And there's the rub, Margaret.
Well, that's right, Mark. And the CBO report, which came out after the House approved the health reform measure, was pretty damning. It predicted that the ACHA would lead to 23 million Americans losing health insurance coverage. And the CBO report also predicted that the ACHA would significantly increase premiums for older and sicker Americans.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already hinted that there may not be a bill that could win the support of 50 GOP senators at the moment, the minimum number needed for any legislation to pass to make it through the Senate, which would then rely on Vice President Mike Pence to cast the deciding vote. There are centrists in the GOP, like Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who say they will not support a bill that eliminates coverage for so many Americans. In the meantime, the process is being carried out in relative secrecy, so we'll have to wait to find out what is in the Senate Republican health bill.
Well, Mark, what we do know in the president's budget is that it signals significant cuts across the healthcare spectrum. In addition to the $800 billion being cut from Medicaid by the GOP health reform measure, President Trump has proposed a significant cut to Medicaid on top of that, which could lead to an estimated $1.7 trillion reduction in funding over 10 years. That is just a devastating blow to healthcare for tens of millions of Americans, and it will have a pretty dramatic impact on the healthcare industry as well.
There's another area that is facing serious cuts under the president's budget, Margaret, and that's biomedical research. The president's proposed funding of the National Institute of Health cuts it by 22%. After years of flat funding at NIH, this will negatively impact funding on research across the board, and it's something that very much concerns our guest today.
Dr. Victor Zhao is the president of the esteemed National Academy of Medicine, a division of the National Academy of Science, whose collective goal is to advance research that supports evidence-based practices in medicine as well as in scientific research. And with that in mind, we thought this would be a good time to revisit our conversation with Dr. Zhao. Looking forward to that conversation, Mark.
I am as well. And Lori Robertson also stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, and is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Victor Zhao in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. They're working behind closed doors on a revised version of the American Healthcare Act. While senators are on Memorial Day break, policy wonks are hard at work in Washington making alterations to the healthcare bill composed by House Speaker Paul Ryan, which passed narrowly in the House. The Senate has a tricky road to navigate. After the House passed their version of the AHCA, the nonpartisan CBO report came out, the Congressional Budget Office revealing the dark underbelly of the bill, namely 23 million Americans losing coverage under the GOP plan, most through a cut to Medicaid funding. And it will certainly lead to higher premiums for those older folks who would no longer maintain federal protections from insurance premium gouging for pre-existing conditions. And as recipients age past the age of 50, their rates will go up exponentially as well. Many members of Congress are home for the recess and facing some angry crowds as a result of their having supported the GOP plan to replace Obamacare. California Congressman Daryl Issa actually holed up on his roof of his office to avoid being confronted by an angry mob outside. Senate leader Mitch McConnell has said publicly that at the moment it doesn't look like they have the necessary votes among the Republican majority to pass the bill that they are currently drafting, whose details are still rather murky. Senators Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska, and Cassidy of Louisiana have said they won't support a bill that eliminates health coverage for tens of millions of Americans. And in Cassidy's case, he made a vow not to put his stamp of approval on a bill that wouldn't pass the Jimmy Kimmel test, a cap on lifetime spending for insurance, especially with children born with life-threatening illnesses. Meanwhile, drug makers have been lobbying Congress, especially the Senate, hard on health reform. While President Trump has said he vows to clamp down on drug prices, one of the drivers of the nation's high health care costs, so far there has been no legislation in that direction. Pharmaceutical industry has spent roughly $80 million in the first quarter alone in lobbying fees. As the weather warms, the CDC warns, brace yourselves for more Zika. The Zika virus made relatively little impact in the continental U.S., although Florida was hard hit. And in all, there were about 5,000 cases of Zika infection reported in the U.S., some of that from foreign travelers, some of the Zika cases through sexual contact. And about 65 babies were born in the U.S. to Zika-infected parents and suffered some birth defects. The U.S. territory of Puerto Rico saw about 35,000 cases and a much higher number of affected offspring. Zika poses the greatest threat to developing fetuses. The CDC warns they simply don't know enough about this year's Zika threat and warn that emergency plans should be put in place ahead of further outbreaks. Meanwhile, the recently released White House budget proposes establishing an emergency fund to finance responses to outbreaks like Zika, but it also calls for a $1.3 billion cut to the CDC and slashes $838 million from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the agency behind vaccine development. So far, there's been little talk from Congress on approving extra funding. And HPV is gaining an edge. Cancers related to the human papillomavirus have spiked in recent years, with more than 30,000 cancers per year being attributed to the sexually transmitted virus. Rates of HPV vaccination, however, have fallen off. And May 31st, the World Health Organization's designated World No Tobacco Day, calling attention to the deadly scourge wrought across the globe due to smoking and tobacco consumption. An estimated 7 million people die worldwide from smoking-related causes every year. And that number is expected to swell to 8 million per year by 2030 without a global intervention. Smoking is responsible for 1 in 5 deaths in this country alone. And the health risks go beyond those who choose to smoke or become addicted to nicotine. Passive smoking and secondhand smoke are leading causes of childhood respiratory illness and cancer in adults as well. The World Health Organization is recommending a number of strategies to combat the tobacco consumption around the world, including more restrictions on tobacco companies' marketing of their products, especially to women, children, and the poor, and raising a higher tax on smoking products has shown a positive effect on reducing consumption. The World Health Organization suggests increasing the tax worldwide by $1 per product could raise close to $200 billion for use in development, as well as smoking cessation and health-related programs. Smoking bans in public spaces have also proven extremely effective. New York City initiated a smoking ban under then-Mayor Michael Bloomberg, leading to what health experts estimate is 10,000 lives saved during that time, mostly by eliminating exposure to secondhand smoke, as well as making it harder for smokers to light up wherever and whenever they want. The World Health Organization's goal is to enhance global productivity by greatly reducing smoking by the year 2030. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine, formerly the Institute of Medicine, a private nonprofit institution providing objective analysis and policy advice to solve the nation's complex problems related to science, technology, and medicine. Dr. Zhao most recently served as chancellor for health affairs at Duke University and president and CEO of Duke University Medical Center, where he launched the Duke Translational Medicine Institute and the Duke Global Health Institute. Prior to that, he was chairman of Harvard's Medical School, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and also served as chairman of the Department of Medicine at Stanford University. University. Dr. Zhao is a renowned researcher whose work led to the development of ACE inhibitors, now used widely for treatment of high blood pressure. Dr. Zhao earned his medical degree from McGill University Medical School in Montreal. Dr. Zhao, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's a great pleasure to be talking to you.
Your appointment at the National Academy of Medicine came at a very interesting inflection point in healthcare. Your background in translational science speaks to the emerging reality of modern healthcare, which increasingly is becoming an interdisciplinary partnership. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how that background is shaping the direction that you're leading the Academy through during this time of transformation in healthcare.
Well, Mark, I would say there's never a more exciting but challenging time in science, medicine, and healthcare. If you look at the advances in science and technology, they're breathtaking. Genome sequencing for $1,000, mm-hmm. precision medicine, stem cell, regenerative medicine, gene editing. And yet, the world is facing unprecedented challenges in, say, increased disease burden, such as obesity, diabetes, emerging infections like Zika and Ebola, antimicrobial resistance. And of course, our healthcare system is fragmented and really too expensive. The National Academy of Medicine has been around for about 50 years, and we found our roots in the National Academy of Science, which was chartered by Abraham Lincoln and Congress to be independent advisors to a nation. Mm-hmm. We must continue to be that evidence-based, trusted advisor and independent from politics or any kind of non-science beliefs. And so we have asked ourselves to be more innovative, more action-oriented. And, you know, we have recently redone our mission statement to say our job is to improve health for all mm-hmm. and to accelerate progress in science, medicine, and policy, but address health equity issues. That's what I hope to bring to National Academy of Medicine.
I look back at the work that you've done. You've served at the helm of a number of the nation's premier medical institutions. Most recently were at Duke, before that at Harvard and Stanford. And you oversaw just a tremendous amount of transformation at Duke, launching both the Global Health and the Translational Science Institute. What did you learn accelerating change at the academic level that's going to inform the work being undertaken at the National Academy of Medicine?
What I've learned in my journey, including my journey through Harvard, Stanford, and Duke, is, of course, it's really important to take a step back and ask ourselves, what exactly are we trying to accomplish? What are we all about? And it is about doing good for society. So one must first articulate your vision and create a very clear strategy going forward, which is, in fact, what we're doing right now, as we have recently reconfigured ourselves to become the National Academy of Medicine. You know, the recent reorganization of the National Academies. We are the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, three academies under the same roof. It's about collaborating across disciplines and creating a culture that really fosters innovation and evidence base so that people can trust us, that what we say are based on facts and the very best minds.
Well, you mentioned earlier a concern about the sort of partisanship that's been happening. I think we're all buoyed by the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act. As you contemplate the new administration, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about their commitment to the advancement of biomedical research.
I'm cautious but optimistic. Mm-hmm. 9 months ago, we anticipated, of course, a change in U.S. administration. Mm-hmm. And so we started this initiative called Vital Directions for Health and Healthcare. Dr. Mark McClellan co-chaired this with me. As you know, he was the previous FDA commissioner and CMS director. He's a Republican. And two of us put together a steering committee of really notable individuals who understand health, but also understand policy and government. We have people like Mike Leavitt mm-hmm. and Tom Daschle. Really, in mm-hmm. many ways, I would say nonpartisan, not even bipartisan.
Right.
And we said, look, it's about what the country needs going forward. And so we worked on policies and actions that can yield timely and measurable progress. And we have three key goals: better health and well-being, high-value healthcare, and strong science and technology. We brought together 150 experts to guide us, and we had a big summit. And right now we are synthesizing all these pieces together so that we can give to the administration 7 very clear priorities that they need to consider going forward. And so I do think there's a real opportunity to work together with the new administration to look at what's ahead of us and what we must do together to improve health of the nation.
I know, Dr. Zhao, that you also have a very significant focus on global health, and you warned that global pandemics could cost the global economy some $6 trillion. What does the National Academy of Medicine recommend as the more sound approach to meeting these global pandemics?
You know, what happens in a far corner of the world can rapidly affect us, you know, be it pandemics, war, security, refugees, climate change, and we have to lead. And, you know, certainly we are all together trying to improve the planet. Everything is hyperconnected. Health influences economy, it influences national and global security. That's what our report said. I think that the decision makers understand that if we stand on the sideline and we don't invest enough in health, we may end up with negative impact on the economy and security. Take, for example, Ebola. During the outbreak, borders were closed, people stopped traveling, lives were lost, and the impact was huge. In our report, when we assessed the loss per year by pandemics in the world, is $60 billion. Mm. So the trillion numbers to say, if you imagine this for a century, and when SARS hit Hong Kong, the airport was literally shut down,
right,
and they lost a lot of money. But I think security is the other issue. Think about the security issue in terms of borders and people moving one to the other. And think about the world now, which these pathogens can be used as weapons. Our report basically highlighted the importance of health in a connected fashion to everything else. You know, we put that much money into homeland security, into military, and to cybersecurity. We got to put money into health security.
We're speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Zhao, as I hear you speak about the work and the mission of the National Academy of Medicine, you stand on the shoulders of so many tireless, dedicated volunteers. And one of the memorable reports was your 1999 report to Air is Human, which shined a spotlight on one of medicine's most concerning shortcomings, the high rate of deaths related to medical errors. And it's now been 17 years since that initial report, and the numbers still remain unacceptably high. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the work that's been done and chart some of the strategies that you have going forward.
First of all, you mentioned with volunteer. I do want to talk about that. We have some 2,000 Academy members who are being elected every year, leading scholars and experts in health and science and medicine. I think we have something like 50 Nobel laureates, so that we have the best minds in engineering and economy, et cetera. So this report, To Air is Human, is an example of the contribution that we can make. 17 years ago, I remember this report that says, you know, up to 90,000 U.S. citizens can die from preventable deaths in the hospital, and it's from errors, and that was a wake-up call. In the last 17 years, the world has gone on a journey of understanding how important it is to say quality is important, safety is important. People are going to make mistakes. However, if we have a system and a culture of patient first, quality of care, safety of care, that system should greatly reduce the error that people can make inadvertently. As you know, I was at Duke, and we had some infamous cases of patient safety problems.
Right.
We learn a huge amount. We have to have a culture where people say, if I see something that's not right, I can speak up and there'll be no retribution. So if I look back on 17 years, I'll say that the impact is enormous, you know, from almost like a dark ages to where we are today, using now, of course, technological tools to report, to track, and we're able to collect much better numbers than we collected 17 years ago. I'm sure you followed that ARC 2016 reported the data showing that some of the changes they put in place, particularly in terms of measuring hospital performance, have greatly reduced errors and saved lives and saved money. So we're going to be vigilant and keep doing better.
Well, Dr. Zhao, another area where we admire and follow the National Academy of Medicine is in its commitment to fostering workforce development. So as you know, the Academy released a lauded, groundbreaking report, The Future of Nursing, several years ago. They followed up with a report just about a year ago, I think, looking at progress on those recommendations. Can you address that initiative and how the National Academy of Medicine is working to advance that cause?
When I was at Duke, I was responsible for the nursing school as well, and the medical school and the hospitals. And I see the centrality of nursing in frontline, but also in education and research. And in fact, if you look at our report, it's the most downloaded report ever.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And I think what this report really said was we have to have nurses practice the full extent of their education training and not the old days where, you know, they are just to serve the doctors, particularly when you think about what they can do and how compassionate and capable they are, and the fact that we have shortage of physicians, nurses should lead, should practice to full extent education. The report says they should have high levels of education because the evidence show the more educated the nurses are, the better the patient outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their goals to say how many must obtain a baccalaureate degree, how many should get higher education, doctor of nurse practice and PhDs, etc. And the report says they should be full partners with physicians and other healthcare providers, and they should become involved with effective workforce planning. Shortly after release report, RWJ launched this Future of Nursing Campaign for Action,
mm-hmm.
which they say, how to implement all those recommendations? So we have certainly seen changes in states that remove major barriers and given full practice authority to nurse practitioners. But let me say that it's not just nursing. It's interprofessional education. There's a recognition that we work around the patient and the team supporting the patient. Doctors, nurses, but also social workers,
mm-hmm.
pharmacists. Certainly when I was at Duke, we pushed for what we call interprofessional education, getting people from different professions to work together early during their training to learn to work as a team, working for the same purpose, which is improve care for the patient.
Dr. Zhao, you were saying that we want to contribute to the health of our people and globally. And I was thinking about the work that's happening over at the NIH with their Precision Medicine Initiative, this Million Lives study that the president has been behind. Certainly the 21st Century Cures Bill is adding some money to it. Thoughts about genomics, that sort of intersection of medicine, science, and personalized health? Many of the ways they've tried to put this together is a sort of an interdisciplinary approach, trying to bring everybody to the table.
Right.
Some thoughts
and
about that?
More than that, they bring patients to the table.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
It's a big voluntary program where we want people to volunteer, being willing to share their DNA information, being willing to see that this is collectively where we can learn from engaging the patient population. So a big part of this is, in fact, engaging patients. You know, I think this Precision Medicine Initiative is one of the signature initiatives of President Obama. I certainly feel that he's been a great supporter of science and health. Look at some of the initiatives he's taken on in brain, precision medicine, and many other areas. As you all know, the promise of precision medicine is that we'll be able to develop the tools that can precisely identify the appropriate vulnerable individuals and very early intervene, if not find specific treatment. Sequencing human genome is only one part of information.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get a lot of other information to link them together. That includes all the omics technology, biomarkers, but also the data that you can collect from electronic health record, from the wearables, mm-hmm. biosensors, from big data. And because of these huge amount of scientific and clinical information, there's a long way to go to be able to collect them, to coordinate them, being able to analyze them, and to make useful information out of them. But importantly, we have to address, of course, patient privacy. We have to understand security of the data. So this initiative is really moving the whole nation forward for the future, and I'm very excited about this.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences. You can learn more about their work by going to nam.edu. Dr. Zhao, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
What a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price made two claims about opioid addiction that are contradicted by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the department Price heads. Price made his claims while in West Virginia, the state with the highest rate of opioid-related overdoses in the country. Price said, quote, "Folks need to be cured so they can be productive members of society. But there is currently no cure for addiction to opioids or any other drug. The National Institute on Drug Abuse says, quote, addiction is treatable and can be successfully managed. According to experts, substance use disorder can be successfully treated, but it can't be cured. This is because of the way addiction affects the psychology and brain of an individual. Speaking about treatment, Price claimed, quote, if we're just substituting one opioid for another, we're not moving the dial much. But using opioids to combat addiction to more dangerous opioids, including heroin, is effective, say experts and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. While there is no cure for opioid addiction, medication-assisted treatments, including other opioids, quote, save lives, and, quote, help to stabilize individuals, allowing treatment of their medical, psychological, and other problems so they can contribute effectively as members of families and of society, says the National Institute on Drug Abuse. One expert told us that the science is clear. With medication, addicts have at least double the chance of becoming opioid-free. Nationally, the rate of opioid-related deaths increased from around 3 per 100,000 people in 2000 to more than 10 per 100,000 people in 2015, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Over 33,000 people died of opioid-related overdoses in 2015 alone. This includes both illicit opioids, such as heroin, and prescription opioids, including oxycodone and hydrocodone. In a comment to Stat News, Price's spokesperson said that he supported, quote, expanding access to treatment and recovery services, including medication-assisted treatment. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Diabetes is a chronic illness for which behavioral choices such as diet and exercise are extremely important. But incentivizing behavior change in large patient populations is very challenging. A recent study done by Emory University and a nonprofit organization focused on improving the health of India's population of 1 billion people found that text messages sent through smartphones might be a powerful tool in promoting diabetes prevention behaviors. They partnered with India's leading provider of mobile phones, Nokia, to harness a research cohort of 1 million clients to receive diabetes prevention text messages.
So the text messages themselves were developed with Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health because we wanted them based on science and behavior change theory. And then we adapted them with lots of consumer feedback.
Nalini Saligram, CEO of the Arogya Foundation, the text messaging study was designed to generate improved activity around 4 simple goals: consume more fruits and vegetables, avoid fried foods, and exercise regularly.
You know, the messages themselves were quite simple, but the sequence of the messages and how frequently they were texted was all based on behavior change theory as well as on Nokia's experience from their consumer base.
Participants who received just 2 text messages per week showed an average 40% more compliance with those activities than those who did not receive the messages. It could prove a useful tool for clinicians trying to affect behavior change across large patient populations. A low-cost targeted text messaging system sent directly to consumers, reminding them of the power they have to maintain simple lifestyle changes that can improve their chances of preventing or better managing diabetes and other chronic illnesses. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.